This is Rabbi Josh Yoder of the Stanton Street Shul. Thank you for downloading this class podcast. These classes are provided free of charge through the generosity of the Stanton Street Shul community and supporters like you. If you do enjoy them, please consider making a donation to our synagogue's building fund on our website's shop donate page at www.stantonstshul.com. Good morning. It is Sunday, December 9th, 2012. Today's topic in our series on the halachic process is marita ayin, or as I call, how not to be seen, which, if anyone here, I guess you don't either remember or unaware, is the name of a Monty Python sketch.
Oh.
Well, one of my favorite ones. If anyone's interested, it was the first sketch on the movie, and now for something completely different, which was kind of like their greatest hits. You know, strung together. Mm. Anyway, it's a funny sketch. If you haven't seen it, find it online. So look up and how not to be seen. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to do it this week. I initially thought about doing Minhag this week, but due to some questions that came up, figured I'd shift it to marita ayin. This is a class that I gave actually a couple of years ago when someone asked about this. And it's a really, I think, misunderstood halachic concept or halachic idea where people throw out to justify prohibiting a whole lot of things. Marita ayin, or also called maris ayin, colloquially. Marita ayin is actually how it's used in the Gemara, so that's what I'll try to use more often. But if you're more familiar with the term maris ayin, is, in a nutshell, you shouldn't do certain things because of how it looks. That's an oversimplification, but I think that's how it's actually viewed colloquially. Are anyone familiar with examples about how it's used? Ever hear something used for maris ayin?
There's a rabbi in a prostitution house, and someone comes in and says, "Rabbi Garfinkel, what are you doing in here?" He says, "Well, look, I don't eat here."
Okay. That's an interesting one, and that one I've not heard. I think one of the more common ones you'll find would be things like not going into McDonald's to use the bathroom.
Right.
You know, and does that count as maris ayin or not? Now, intuitively, right, there are some, you know, difficulties that you might have with, well, to what extent are you concerned with what other people are going to think?
Exactly. So, rock bottom, it's not a violation of a halacha. It's just what some idiot yenta is going to think when they see me walking into McDonald's to use the bathroom.
Well, take
and
it
if I'm a real idiot, I'll hold it in and bust my bladder just to avoid being, thought of as being a guy who eats unkosher.
But even take it further. If you've got an overriding ethic to be concerned with how people are going to think of you, how are you ever going to live? You're basically going to define your own religious actions by what other people think.
Which is
and who are these other people? Are they smart people? Are they stupid people? Right? And that would, you know, you could see how if that is an overarching ethic without any parameters, can lead to a complete breakdown of not just religion, but of sanity. So what we're going to try to do today is, you know, we'll shift, I mean, shifting gears a little, but the focus is going to be on the part of halachic process that's concerned with perception. Right, and how things are seen by others, and how you should not be seen, and how exactly was it handled in the Gemara itself? Because the words marita ayin do appear. I mean, it wasn't just invented out of the blue, but I want to demonstrate today how what the Gemara and how the halachic process is defined by Torah Shebaal Peh incorporates marita ayin is not the same as it is done colloquially today. Where, in terms of asking, you know, random people, oh, you can't do that because it's maris ayin because it looks weird. All right? So start us off, Ed. First with a verse in Bamidbar, Numbers 32:22.
Then when the land is subdued before the Lord, you may return and be free from your obligation to the Lord and to Israel, and the land will be your possession before the Lord.
All right? So you have a biblical mandate here about being Nikiyim Hashem Yisrael. To be, you know, sort of, you know, and this, it literally means free from your obligations, but it's, you know, a certain degree of, like, purity or guiltless or blameless. Take the next source that was short. Mishnah and Shkalim 3:2.
The appropriation in the chamber was made with three baskets, each of the capacity of three seahs.
Which is a unit of measurement.
And on them was inscribed, respectively, Aleph, Beis, Gimel. Rabbi Ishmael says, on them was inscribed in Greek, Alpha, Beit, Gamma. He who made the appropriation did not enter the chamber wearing either a bordered cloak or shoes or sandals or tefillin or an amulet, lest if he became poor, people might say he became poor because of an iniquity committed in the chamber. Or if he became rich, people might say he became rich from the appropriation in the chamber. For it is a man's duty to be free of blame before men as before God, as it is said, and be guiltless towards the Lord and towards Israel. And again it so says, so shall thou find favor and good understanding in the sight of God and man.
Okay, so you have a case here where someone who's doing appropriation should, you know, not be wearing certain, it's pretty, you know, well, not a cloak or a certain type of cloak, certain shoes, sandals, tefillin, or an amulet, because if he becomes rich or poor, people can make certain assumptions based on how he dressed and how he entered, right? Now, in this particular case, right, you are concerned with, well, here's what people may say. People can jump to certain conclusions. Now, you could argue today that, you know, rationally, there's no causation between what you wear and becoming rich or poor, right, and whether or not you sin. But in their days, there might have been. But it's important to realize in this particular case, there is a concern for how you're going to proceed by the masses. But in this case, it's specifically for a person of authority, for a person who's in a very public role. You've got one individual in a certain role, right, where, you know, you'll... All right, so here would be another example. Psachim 13a.
For it was taught, when the charity overseers have no poor to whom to distribute their funds, they must change the copper coins with others, not themselves. The overseers of the soup kitchen, when they have no poor to whom to make a distribution, must sell to others, not to themselves, because it is said, and ye shall be guiltless towards the Lord and towards Israel.
Right? So here again, you've got people who are in very public positions of authority, a gabbai tzedakah, right, who is supposed to act above board. If anyone's familiar, we actually had an issue like that in the Lower East Side, the Bialystoker Nursing Home. You hear about that?
No.
So the Bialystoker Nursing Home was hemorrhaging money, and the board sold it, the building, to raise money to pay off debts, to a company owned by the chairman of the board. And there was a big fight contesting the sale. I don't know where it stands as of today. But that would be a good example of, even if it's legal, it certainly is not necessarily the best or optimal way of doing it, because it reeks of insider trading. It reeks of a certain degree of favoritism. Or take it another way. I mean, you all remember the recent Gulf War under Bush, right? Who got the biggest contracts? Halliburton. Remember that?
Yeah.
Right? So who is the former head of Halliburton? Dick Cheney, vice president at the time. Right? Now, whether or not anything was legal or illegal in there, it certainly gives the appearance of impropriety, of an abuse of power, of using a position where you're entrusted with resources, in particular resources of others, and diverting those funds
into your own pocket.
Or if not to your own pocket, to do so favorably without favorably on your terms, however that means, but certainly without transparency, if not, as you would say, directly into your own pocket. It could be legal, it could be just, but it doesn't pass the smell test, you know, as they say.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why, you know, if Bialystoker had sold it to someone else, one of the other issues that, you know, had with the Bialystoker nursing home was that the building was sold for $1 million, which is crazy cheap for a building of that size, right? So it's like, oh, we sold it for a sweetheart deal too. You know, you could argue the same thing with Halliburton. It, even if everything is in fact above board, it doesn't seem right, right? So that is another way that, you know, those two cases are similar instances where we are halachically concerned for perception, but again, it seems to be focused on leadership, right? More of a rule, so if someone's in charge, higher profile means we're going to hold you to a higher standard. And we understand why, because if a leader is found to be inept or even corrupt, or even if he's not corrupt, if it seems and he gives off the appearance of not being completely just, well, that means that the masses are going to start losing their faith in the entire system.
I'm thinking of Mayor Bloomberg, who after two terms he should have packed in and left. And because of his money, he was able to stretch it to a third term.
That's not entirely true. The reason why I don't think that's a same example is that he only was able to get a third term with everyone else voting for it. And there was there were people on the council who were more duplicitous, who got up and who ranted against like how the term limits were a breach of democracy and then voted for it. Additionally, just because he voted to get past the term limits, you still had to vote for him. Right, he could have lost the election in theory, right? But that wasn't, you know, you can, you know, say that he didn't do something right, but it wasn't the same abuse of power. Everything there done was in accordance with the charter and was done very publicly, right? You could see who were the council people that voted to, you know, extend the term limits. And even that wasn't, you know, make me saying I want to be mayor for life without an election. That would be more, you know, corrupt than say saying I want to have another election. Because you're still leaving it up to the people. And however you want to criticize the elections in New York or in America, we're still a lot better than, say, elections in most places in the Middle East. Mm. All right. Next, we got a Gemara in Yoma 38a. Our rabbis taught the house of Garmu was expert in the preparing of the showbread, but would not teach it. The sages sent for specialists from Alexandria of Egypt, who knew how to bake bread as well as they, but they did not know how to take the loaves down from the oven as well as the former. For they were heating the oven from without and baked from within, whereas the latter heated the oven from within and baked from within, with the result that the bread of the latter became moldy, whereas the bread of the former did not grow moldy. When the sages heard that, they quoted, "Everyone that is called in the page my name and whom I have created my glory," and said, "Let the house of Garmu return to their office." The sages sent for them, but they would not come. When they doubled their hire, and they came. Until now, they used to get 12 minas for the day. From that day, 24 minas. Rav Judah said, until then they received 24, and from that they received 48. Fine. The sages said to them, "What ground did you see for refusing to teach your art?" They said to them, "In our father's house they knew that this house would be destroyed, and perhaps an unworthy man would learn it, and then proceed to serve an idol with it. For the following was their memory honored. Never was fine bread to be found in their children's hand, lest people say, these feed from the preparation of the shewbread. Thus they endeavored to fulfill the command, 'You shall be clear before the Lord and before Israel.'" Right? So you had bakers who were very protective of their craft, let someone abuse it. Again, you have people who are trying to, who were in a position where, whatchamacallit, you have people who are in a specific position, a specific skill, who did not want some official business, in this case temple business, to be used in the wrong hands, and what people might say if it would. So, and again, all under that same, under the principle of that pasuk that we had from Bamidbar, the ten mikiim eshem Yisrael, you know, be guiltless or be blameless before God and before Israel. So there's some concern about what are people going to think, especially if you're going to be in a high-profile position. All right. So let's look at some Mishnaic examples of when maritain is used. Ed? This is Kelaim 3:5.
"One may plant a cucumber and a gourd in one declivity, provided only that one species incline in one direction and the other in the opposite direction, or that the tips of the leaves of one species incline one way and the other the opposite way. Since all sages' prohibitions in the matter of Kelaim were decreed by them, on account of appearances."
So here, you can grow. So there's a prohibition. There are biblical prohibitions against crossbreeding. So when you are farming, if anyone's interested, there's a farm in Baltimore as part of the Pearlstone Center called Kayam, and they actually have like little demonstrations of halachic farming, which is very hard to find in America. Like in Israel, where they still keep the laws, agricultural laws are applicable on more Jewish farm, people do it. In America, you don't have too many Jewish farmers, so not many people know about kelaim. At any rate,
I'm sorry to interrupt so early. There's also one in Connecticut called Adama.
Really?
It's associated with the Isabella Friedman Center.
Ah, fantastic. And they also, like, set up stuff with, like, here's key lime, he's not key lime, and...
I don't know that it's for public display, but they have rabbinical supervision.
Well, this one, they actually like have like tours every now and again. They'll like show you like, you know, and explain. Anyway, right. So there's a concern here. Like, if you're going to plant gourds, even if it could be okay, like to plant them close enough. I mean, there's certain things you can. There's a certain distance that you have to separate. You have to put them in the opposite direction, bipenei marita ayin, because of how it appears. In this case, you've got, if you don't do it in a certain way, the appearance is that what you have done is violated law, in that there's a certain decree, the sages decreed, that when you plant these gourds, here's how you do it, and the grounds is, no pun intended there, is that you don't want to give the appearance that you're planting kilayim, right? Or at least from a distance. So the problem here is it looks like you're doing something that's actually prohibited. That's one. Take the next one, also from Kilayim 9.2. Shalamath?
Gam is made of a mixture of silk and floss silk. Do not come under the prohibition of Kilayim, but are prohibited on account of appearances. Two mattresses and pillows, the prohibition of Kilayim does not apply, provided one's flesh does not come into immediate contact with the mixed material.
Yeah, I could probably like cut out the rest because the rest doesn't really talk about marita ayin. All right, so here, all right, so silk and floss silk don't come under the prohibition of kilayim, but Chazal, the rabbis, it says in b'mishum kilayim aval osurim, it was forbidden. Right, the sages enacted a prohibition here mipenei marita ayin because these two types of silk or silk and floss silk apparently look too close, like linen and wool, which are prohibited to wear like woven together, because that's the prohibition of shatnez. You can wear certain garments that looked like shatnez. So Chazal said, even though it's not technically prohibited, right? Or not technically prohibited, even though it's not biblically prohibited, we are saying you can't do it because of marita ayin. Alright? Dana? Shvi'it 3-4.
Yeah. He who allows cattle to change folds within his field must make an enclosure two seahs in area. He then pulls out three sides thereof and leaves the middle side. He will then possess a fold of four seahs space. Rav Shimon ben Gamliel says, even one of eight seahs may be used. If his entire field is only four seahs in area, he must allow a portion thereof to remain unenclosed for appearance's sake. He may take...
In this case, also for marita ayin. Right, so if you've got a large area, right, you still have to have some of it like open again for marita ayin, because of how does it look if you've got a public field that seems to be like all closed off. Any other ones? Right, we have a Mishnah in Shabbat that says these are the shreds which invalidate circumcision, flesh that covers the greater part of the corona. He must not partake of the teruma, and if he is fleshy, he must repair it for appearance's sake. If one circumcises but does not uncover the circumcision, it is as though he is not circumcised. Now, this seems to be, of the Mishnayot that we've seen up until now, everything else that we've seen so far are things that are, kind of public, meaning whether or not you grow kilayim, right, is something that's, generally done in public because people can pass by your field. But what clothing you wear is a matter of public. Whether or not your field is enclosed or not enclosed, that's going to be public. Whether or not your meal is covered over or not, hopefully is not as public. I mean, maybe back then, there was people may have been more open with nakedness in public bathhouses. But yeah, it's still not. I mean, there was a joke one of my rebbeim used to say when people would say, like, oh, you have to wear your tzitzit out, meaning the fringes out, because you want to show people you're doing the mitzvah, and it's fun. Really, do you show everyone your mila? Meaning about showing people that you, yeah, never mind.
Is it possible that they're referring to a public bris ceremony where people would actually have a chance of seeing it?
Unlikely, because it says here, he must not partake of the truma. Now, unless you're like an eight-day-old, right,
yeah,
you're not really caring so much about truma there. Right, and the kid certainly doesn't know about it. Right, and finally, a charum is unfit for the priesthood. This is a Mishnah in Bechorot 7:3. What is charum? One who can paint both of his eyes with one movement, meaning possessing no nose, so that nothing prevents him from proceeding to paint one eye to the other in one movement. One whose two eyes are above or two eyes are below, a person whose one eye sees above and the other sees it below, one who takes in the room and the ceiling in one glance, all and one who covers his eyes from the sun, a Zagdim, a Ziron, all of these are unfit for the priesthood. One whose eyelids have fallen off is unfit for the priesthood for appearance's sake. Right? Shinuri risei naf pasomi pene marita ayin, which incidentally is a hilarious pun given this Mishnah. Well, for me at least. There you go.
Yeah.
Right, so in these cases, so in the, a priest cannot serve if he has a mum, if he has a certain type of blemish. So in these cases, there's a decree saying you can't, certain people can't do certain things because the, even though it might be technically okay, it looks bad to others. Yeah.
Just it's an association to number 8 with the circumcision issue. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you'd comment. I was reading Commentary magazine, and there's a thing in Germany that they're trying to outlaw circumcision.
Ah, they did. They had a rabbi, and I forget where it is now, but there was a judge that ruled circumcision was illegal or something like that. Yeah.
So what do you think? It's like ominous for the Jews? They're going to start the whole thing all over again?
It's a bit off topic. I mean, it's certainly a sign of concern, but it's one of those things that people are aware enough, and Germany doesn't have the best track record when it comes to treating Jews, that people are going to be a little more sensitive. Now, granted, there has been a lot of progress there. You know, I spoke to a friend of mine in Germany about it who had no idea what was going on, so I don't know how widespread it is. It's too off topic. We could choose about that afterwards. On to Marsine. Back to Marsine, I should say.
Men wore eyeliner back then?
I think it was more...
Or rather, eyeshadow.
I think they kind of did, from my understanding. Like, I know it was popular in Egypt at a certain time, so I don't know what things were like. Well, I mean, also late. I mean, I don't know what the real custom was in the time of the Mishnah for that. Or couldn't it be, you know, if he theoretically could do it, not that if he would. I can't answer the cosmetology. It's not cosmetology. Cosmology? What is
it? No, cosmetology.
It's cosmetology.
Right.
Okay.
Cosmology.
I got cosmology.
Cosmetics.
Yeah, cosmetology and cosmology sometimes get
cosmology,
confused.
Cosmology, you're going to outer space.
Yeah. Well. Alrighty. So these are a couple of Mishnaic ideas. Mm. Now, there are two things that, you know, patterns, you know, that I think are here. One is that, you know, the concern is you don't, there are decrees made that you shouldn't do one thing or another because of maritain, because of how it looks. In some cases, it was because it looks like you're doing something wrong, right, in terms of very public. On the other, even though you might not be, and for the others, or at least, you know, for the Kohen one, it seems wrong. Meaning, you know, it's one of those things where it doesn't look right. Like a Kohen who doesn't have, you know, eyelids, right? Now, I have no idea how they blink. But, you know, if it looks off, it seems it should be umum. So because of that, you know, there's a special decree that's saying this cannot happen because we are concerned with what people might say. Now let's go through a little bit more. Now we're going to shift to the Babylonian Talmud, see if we've got a little bit more here. So start us off at this section, Ed, with Shabbat 61a.
Our rabbis taught, what is an approved amulet? One that is healed once, a second time, and a third time, whether it is an amulet in writing or an amulet of roots, whether it is for an invalid whose life is endangered or for an invalid whose life is not endangered.
Mm-hmm.
It is permitted not only for a person who has already had an epileptic fit, but even merely to ward it off. And one may tie and untie it even in the street, providing he does not secure it with a ring or a bracelet, or go out therewith into the street for appearance's sake. If secured with a ring or a bracelet, it looks like being worn as an ornament, which it is not, and it would be forbidden to wear it as such.
All right, so that's the explanation there, and then it goes through like an approved amulet. So this is talking, it's, I think, one of the stranger laws that you'll find in Gemara Shabbat. I thought about teaching this for yesterday, because it was in last week's Daf Yomi. In the time of the Gemara, in this particular section, they're discussing about certain types of healing amulets. I think it's an amulet with God's name written in it somehow, don't have all the details, and somehow this was considered a healing amulet. What's fascinating about this Gemara, so when they say, what is an approved amulet, is one of them is if it heals three times, meaning In their way,
first time could be a coincidence.
Well, not just coincidence. It's a matter of, you know, as today, you might think it's completely irrational of, like, how does an amulet heal? But it shows that they had some degree of a scientific method of reproducibility, right? That if it works a few times, like, they may not necessarily know how or why, but the fact that it can work three times, well, that must mean it can work, because three times wouldn't be a coincidence, and three times is what you call in halakha chazaka, where you have a newly established status quo, right?
Did you call a mezuzah an amulet?
No, not at all.
So what defines an amulet?
This was something... Well, here, I mean, there was, you know, they had some writing, they had roots, it could be anything that was used that you would take with you for the purposes of healing. But the catch is, how do you carry it out? All right? So if you secure it to a ring or a bracelet, then it looks like you're wearing it as jewelry. And wearing jewelry on Shabbat is actually not permitted, or at least many forms of jewelry. Yeah, it's a halacha which, I, you know, many people can actually teach in shul because no one's going to listen to them. but even though an amulet might be okay, right? They said you can only do it in a certain circumstance because of how, you know, it's going to look or how it's going to be perceived. Yeah.
The whole carrying keys on a necklace thing, no good?
Talk to me afterwards. Yeah. We'll skip that. We'll actually get back to the last verse. I should probably move that to the end. All right, Shalom, could you take verses 12a and 12b? This is Mishnah Beitza 1:3 and Gemara Beitza 9a.
Skipping 11.
Yeah, we're going to skip 11. I'll go back to that because I think it'll work better at the end. Should probably move that to the end.
This so, time I say one may not carry a ladder on a festival from one dovecote to another, but he may incline it from one communion hole to another. But they permit this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. See a 9a. Others say thus. Rabbi Hanan Ami said, the dispute refers to private ground. For Beth Shemai accept the teachings of Rav Judah in the name of Rav, and Beth Hillel reject the teaching of Rav Judah in the name of Rav, but on public ground all agree that it is forbidden. Shall it be said that Rav ruled as Beth Shemai? Is it a controversy of Tanaim, for it was taught, he may spread them out in the sun, but not in the presence of people. Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Shimon forbid this.
Right. So you have a distinction here about certain things can be done, and you don't have the actual term of like Mari Ta'ayat. One second here. For some reason, I...
The hell is a dove coat?
One second. For some reason, I'm a Rav. Oh, this is annoying. No, I have the absolute wrong English. Do I think I have the wrong English translation here? Huh. Knew something seemed weird. Okay.
So much for that. On to the next.
Well, no, the truth is an important one. We'll have to go back to that one. I'm sorry about that. Not sure why. All right, hold on to that. We'll go back to 11.2. All right, so do number 13 instead. I'm sorry, it was the right Gemara for Beitza 9a, but for some really inexplicable reason, never mind. All right, so forget that. Put a pin in that. Do source number 13, Bava Metzia 89b.
Our rabbis taught, when cows stamp pollen grain or thresh truma and tithes, there are no prohibitions of thou shalt not muzzle the ox when he treadeth out, threshes his corn. But for the sake of appearances, he must bring a handful of that species and hang it on the nose bag at its mouth.
All right, so there's a concern here in terms of when you're doing, if you're using your cow, right, to sort of, you know, do your, you know, grash, you know, mashing the grain stuff for you, right? You don't have to necessarily muzzle it, but you're supposed to put something over its mouth so that it doesn't appear that the whatever the cow's going to eat isn't the stuff that, you know, could be truma having taken stuff away from it. All right? Again, for appearance's sake, you're concerned, what does it look like? In this case, it looks like the cow could be doing something wrong. Dana, take next, Gemara, Avodah Zarah 12a.
If there's a spring flowing in front of an idol, he should not bend down and drink, because he may appear to be bowing to the idol. But if not apparent, It is permitted. One should not place one's mouth on the mouth of human figures which act as water fountains in the cities for the purpose of drinking, because he may be seen as kissing the idolatrous figure. So also one should not place one's mouth on a water pipe and drink therefrom for fear of danger. What is meant by not being apparent? Shall we say that he is not seen? Surely Rabbi Yehuda stated in the name of Rab that whatever the sages prohibited merely because it may appear objectionable to the public is also forbidden in one's innermost chamber. It can only mean that if by bending he will not appear to be bowing, to not appear as bowing to the idol. And all three instances given are necessary. For if we were taught the case of the splinter only, we would have thought it is forbidden, because he can well walk away from his idol and take it out. But in the case of the coins, where this could not be done, the prohibition does not apply. If, on the other hand, we were given the case of the coins only, we might say that the prohibition holds good, because only a loss of money is incurred. But in the case of the thorn, where pain is caused, the prohibition is not to be applied. Were we given both these instances, we might still say that the prohibition applied to them, because there's no danger involved. But in the case of the spring, where there is danger, for it may mean dying of thirst, we might say that the prohibition should be waived, hence all the instances are necessary.
Okay. So do we understand at least, you know, even aside from that last paragraph about, you know, the three instances, why you need them all listed, do you understand, like, going back what the initial prohibitions were? Right? If you got, like, a water fountain out in public, you don't drink from it, like, if it's by an idol, because it looks like you're either bowing down to an idol, or it could look like you're kissing an idol, right? You ever see those statues, you know, that spew water out, you know, the fountain things, right? So let's say you want to drink from that, then it looks like you're actually kissing the...
This assumes that the water is spouting out of the idol's mouth.
Well, that does seem to be, you know, what is implied here.
If the guy is dying of thirst, I don't think he should worry about this halakha. He should go drink, because otherwise he'll be dead.
Well, look, assuming it's sakanat nefashot, if it's a life or death situation, you know, that's something else.
Okay,
right?
I just wanted to throw that in.
Right. However, what do we learn here about Mari Ta'ayin? In particular, the statement from Yehuda in the name of Rab, which was actually in source number 11, that I just took out. But the truth is, it appears a few other times. Mm. And it's an incredibly important, if not the most important, dictum in terms of understanding Mari Ta'ayin. Right? The concern here is, you're not allowed to do this because here's what other people are going to, you know, say. But there's a distinction here of Ilmale de lo mitchazeh. What happens if you're not going to be seen? What's the law? So, what's reviewed in the name of Rav's?
Even in the innermost chamber.
Right. B'chadrei chadarim asur. Why?
Because you don't want to get accustomed to that kind of behavior.
So you're saying it's a matter of getting accustomed to it. But what would be the difference about being accustomed? Meaning, there are plenty of things that we do in private that we don't do in public, and we have the good sense just to do it at home and not do it in public. Right? So why would that necessarily matter?
This is like the Ganav and the Goslin thing in Mishpatim, where the armed robber is punished.
But that's when you're doing something intrinsically prohibited. Here you're doing something which is technically permitted, but the sages prohibited it because of Mari Ta'ayin.
Even if it's in your own house and nobody sees.
Exactly.
I would say these sages have to be limited in their power.
Okay.
They're gung-ho, but making all sorts of crazy prohibitions.
God's going to see you?
What do you think?
God should know the difference.
Any thoughts?
I'm not sure.
Take a sat. All right, unless you really don't want to, so I don't want to embarrass anyone here. So, my understanding, and I think this is really the clutch part of Mari Ta'ayin, is that it is not, when it, all these examples that we gave are does not reflect a universal ethic that you always have to be concerned with, are people going to think you're doing a prohibition? I repeat that. there is not a universal ethic that you have to be concerned with are people thinking you're doing something wrong. Yes, we had an exception with things. If you're in a public position, you have to act above board so that people don't start talking behind your back. That's something else, because that's about, you know, the respect of your authority. But here we're talking about regular Isurim. What happens here? Chazal made certain decrees, made certain acts of legislation to prohibit certain activities. The reason why they prohibited them was Marita Ayin, which means it is a legitimate reason for enacting specific decrees, but it is not an overarching universal rule that you need to look over your shoulder. And the reason why this works, based on this line of based on Rabbi Yehuda in the name of Rav, Kol makom she'asru chachamim mipnei marit ha'ayin, afilu b'chadrei chadarim asur, makes sense based on everything that we've seen so far in this class in the halachic process about how decrees are made. In the halachic system defined by Chazal, the reason for a decree does not matter. Once a decree is made and they say X is prohibited, it doesn't matter why.
No matter how stupid the rule.
No, but it's not a matter of no matter how stupid the rule. It's no matter if the reason for the rule is in effect or not. Meaning if I say this is prohibited because of Marita Ayin, even though there's no Marita Ayin, it is still prohibited. Why? Because Marita Ayin is the reason for the justification. In order for me to overturn that gezerah and that takana, then we need to have a sit down, need to have another act of legislation, say, you know what? This doesn't apply anymore, we can overturn it. But until that act of legislation happens, right, then just as we don't say batel ta'am batel gezerah, when the reason goes away, the law goes away, I mean, that idea is rejected in the Gemara and Beitza, which we saw a couple of weeks ago, so too Marita Ayin, the things that were prohibited because of Marita Ayin, are prohibited in the innermost chamber. That's how it makes the most sense, in my opinion. And it's their way of, Rav Yehuda Amar Rav is explicitly saying that just because the reason for the decree doesn't apply, doesn't mean that the decree doesn't apply. Once Chazal make the legislation, yes, sometimes they will tell you, here's why we're doing it, but just because they tell you why they're doing it doesn't mean if the reason goes away that now it's all of a sudden it's okay.
This is too much loading the dice in favor of Chazal. Whatever they say stands unless a special meeting is held. Who the hell are they anyway?
Because that's the legislative process. Just like today, if someone came by and blew up the Supreme Court, all of their decisions would stand until you reconstituted the Supreme Court and they overturned a previous decision. Every law made by Congress, if someone, let's say next, a State of the Union, someone drops a nuke on Washington, D.C., right? So you've eliminated the Senate, you've eliminated the House of Representatives, you've eliminated pretty much everyone.
A lot of useless politicians.
Well, you could argue that, but it's pretty much everyone except for, what, Secretary of something?
They pick someone.
Yeah, they pick some random person from the cabinet just in case someone does, in fact, blow up the Capitol building during the
Senate. Secretary of Agriculture, it often is.
Agriculture?
Like, he's like 13th in the line of succession.
Huh, okay. So everyone except for him. So the Secretary of Agriculture, assuming this happens, is going to have to reconstitute everything. We're going to have a new House, new Senate, new Supreme Court. Until all of that happens, every single law on the books, both that were legislated by the Senate and the House of Representatives and signed by the President, and every decision made by the Supreme Court is going to be law of the land until such time as
it's reversed.
That's how it works. It's not just a huge power play. It's a matter of what was the legal system that was set up by the sages. And keeping in that consistently, here's how it works. Now, as I said before, you know, practical Ashkenazi practice is crazy inconsistent with batel ta'am batel gezerah. And when they say, oh, well, that law of the sages only applied for certain cases but not others, and other times they'll say, God forbid halacha should change with the times. Right? If you tried holding this, like, to find a general in Ashkenazi halachic, you will not find one because it is comically inconsistent, especially trying to read some apologetics behind it. In particular, there's one Hilchot Shabbat book I have that I've been looking up for reference more, and he's just really awful in terms of when. It's like, oh yes, you know, our great rabbis interpreted it this way, so now it's fine. Now there's like, well, we're not allowed to change anything. Well, but if you actually like think about it a little bit more than just what they say, you realize culturally it's almost a game. But on a halachic legal perspective, it's consistent. Mm-hmm. And it's all based on that same world here of, you know, whatever is asur because of merit ta'ayin is asur in chadrei chadarim. This is how I think it makes the most sense. By the same token, it also helps us explain what is merit ta'ayin. And think about how that, you know, might work in a bit. I forget where we're up to.
15.
No, I know, but who is reading? Ed, fine. Take us with 15.
15.
Yeah.
What is the practical difference between a priest with a blemish and one who is not like the seed of Aaron? The difference is whether the temple service is profane. If it is an actual blemish, the surface is profane. For it is written, because he hath a blemish, that he profaneth not. If, however, it is a case of not being like the seed of Aaron, then the temple service is not profane. What is also the difference between the case of one who is not like the seed of Aaron and of a priest who is unfit for appearance sake? Differences as regards the transgression of a positive precept.
All right, so Marit Ayin here isn't considered a lav, right? Someone who is not considered like the children of Aaron because of Marit Ayin, of how they look, it's Ika B'Nayu Aseh. There's something missing in terms of a positive commandment here, but there's no prohibition, an innate biblical or rabbinic prohibition about worrying about other people. Meaning Marit Ta'ayin is a reason for certain decrees, but it is not the decree itself. Okay? Mm-hmm. So in this case here again, the problem with Marit Ta'ayin is a bitul aseh, not you're not allowed to do something, but rather it's something to be avoided. It's a concern for certain decrees to be avoided, but that doesn't mean it's intrinsically prohibited. Because otherwise, as we said at the beginning, in le devar sof, you're never going to be able to live if you're constantly looking over your shoulder thinking, what's some idiot going to think about what I'm doing? Shall us take the next one, Bechorot 43b.
A bald-headed person is unfit, said Robert. This is meant only where he has not a line of hair from ear to ear in the hinder part, but he has it in the front. But where he has this both in the hinder and in the front part, he is fit for temple service. And this is certainly the case where he has a line of hair in the hinder part and not in the front part. Some there are who refer Rava's explanation to the second clause. If he has, then he is fit, said Rava. This is meant only where he has the line of hair in the hinder part, but not in the front part, but where he has this both in the hinder and front part, he is unfit. And this is certainly the case where he has the line of hair in the front part and not in the hinder part. And this is also certainly the case where he has no line of hair at all, but he is unfit.
Yeah, turn the pages more. Yeah, hair club for Kohanim.
Said Rabbi Yonahan, yep. Bald heads, dwarfs, and the blear-eyed are unfit for the priesthood because they are not like the seed of Aaron. But have we not already learnt both the cases of bald heads and dwarfs in the Mishnah? Rabbi Yohanan needs to teach us the case of the blear-eyed not mentioned in the Mishnah. And even with regard to the rest, you might have thought that their unfitness was for appearance sake. But does not the Tana already state explicitly wherever it is a case for appearance sake, for it says, if his eyelids are hairless, he is unfit for appearance sake? You might, however, have assumed that he states one case, but the same applies to the rest. But does not the Tana, wherever there is an example of unfitness for appearance sake, repeat this as in the following? One whose teeth were removed is unfit for the priesthood, for appearance sake. Rather, the explanation is that the purpose of Rabbi Yohanan is to exclude what has been taught. Bald heads, dwarfs, and the blear-eyed are fit for the priesthood, and they have been stated to be disqualified only for appearance sake. Who is this Tana? It is Rabbi Judah. For it has been taught, Rabbi Judah says, Scripture says, the priest intimating the inclusion of bald heads as fit for priestly service.
So at the end, after all that, the point is, you've got different criteria for physical blemishes for what's for a kohen. I mean, this is based on the Mishnah that we saw earlier. We'll actually can skip the last one because it just gets into a little more detail here. But again, technically, it would be okay. But it's because of how it's going to look, and you know, again, certain degrees of appearance, be pene mari ta'ayin. But it's not the same as that you actually did something wrong. That's how are certain things going to be perceived by others. So even though it's technically okay, there are certain decrees that Chazal are going to enact if, in their minds, the perception would somehow be significantly bad or significantly critical in the eyes of the masses. So I would say things today, in terms of the halachic system, you know, applying today, mari ta'ayin would be a still legitimate reason if a rabbi would say, this and this is bad, or don't do it. However, it's going to have to be a judgment call, but it's not going to be an intrinsic prohibition. So take the case that we said at the beginning about like entering a McDonald's to use the bathroom, right? We can understand why someone would say, don't do this because of mari ta'ayin. Does that mean it's an intrinsic prohibition in Isur? Absolutely not. Why? Because Chazal never said that was prohibited. It's only for the things they said were prohibited because of Mari Ta'ayin are actually prohibited. Not because the Mari Ta'ayin part matters. It's prohibited because there was a rabbinic decree. Now, you could use the ethic behind it to apply it to modern day, but then you're reduced to a judgment call because no one today has the same authority as Chazal that we can legislate for all time and space. I could say that in some cases, entering a McDonald's is mari ta'ayin, and other times it's not. I can say it for certain people, it's a bigger problem than others. I could say it for different cities or states. Going into a McDonald's in the heart of Williamsburg might be one thing to use the bathroom than if I do it in, say, Topeka, Kansas, right? Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, it's not that they're different halachot per se, it's just you're applying a certain ethic differently, because there is no uniform halacha of mari ta'ayin. It's an ethic that Chazal used as a reason to make certain decrees. Once they've made certain decrees, the reason of mari ta'ayin is irrelevant, which is why it's still applicable in your innermost house, as private as you could possibly be, even if there's no chance at all of someone actually seeing you do whatever it is that they ossered, because it's not the reason that matters as much as the gzeirah, the takana, the actual act of legislation, where they said, this is now prohibited. Make sense? Not where you agree. Does it make sense?
Sure.
I don't care if you agree with it. Just has to make sense with it.
I can follow the logic, even though I disapprove of the...
That works for... I can live with that. Yeah.
Well, the thing with baldness is you can come by baldness in several ways. No, I'm saying, you know, if somebody is...
Look, if you're working for the... You know, in the kahuna, you might even pull it out yourself. It's not an easy job.
Okay, but given that there are a lot of men who just start losing their hair after a certain age, do we say that, well, somebody turned 45, started losing their hair, in 6 months they're going to be pustle for...
My understanding is, however you define absur for the kahuna, you know, they said here you need to be, like, say, completely bald, but as long as you're okay, you're okay. Like, you know, if you lose a limb or have certain types of, you know, other physical blemishes that come up, you know, they could happen during a normal life.
Yeah.
But until that happens, you're fine. Mm-hmm. It's only once you've reached that threshold, you know, it's like you do it until you can't.
Also then, if it's a mari ta'ayin issue, would a toupee fix that?
An interesting point. Would a toupee pick? I would guess no. And the reason why is because wigs were not... There was something called Peyan Nochrit in the time of the Mishnahs. Comes up in Shabbos. About Peyan Nochrit means foreign hair, otherwise known as wigs. And how women are not allowed to go out on Shabbat, let's say assuming there's no Eruv, wearing a wig. It's a wonderfully ignored halacha, especially for people who don't. I mean, if you have an Eruv, or at least if you have a kosher Eruv, it wouldn't be a problem. If you don't have a kosher Eruv, it is a sur d'rabanan for a woman to go out wearing a wig on Shabbat. Didn't make that up. Right, so they understood what it was. It seemed like they did have something called a wig, but it seemed to be, based on how that mission is phrased, something used exclusively by women. And in that respect, it was the reason why it's only derabbanan d'oraita is because it's considered like jewelry, and it's considered an adornment specifically for the husband. So the woman can go out to a courtyard, but not to a public domain, because it's only supposed to be to make her look nicer for her husband, right? So I don't know, like, so they did have something called a wig in the time of the Gemara, or sorry, in the time of the Mishnah, but it might have only been reserved for women. But it would be an interesting, you know, question there about Mayatarin, or, you know, cosmetic surgery for a whole bunch of other things, if it's just for appearances' sake, for, you know, anything, guys a scar, you know, laser removal. Yeah, those are going to be questions that are going to come up when we have a Beis HaMikdash, and people are going to start asking all these questions, and thankfully they're not going to be depending on me to give them answers for this sort of thing. Yeah. All right, does this all make, so you're okay with the Mari Dayan thing?
Yeah, I wanted to make a comment.
Sure.
And the case where, they also, I heard that's another reason why they didn't want people to take the train on, like, Yantov, because there's many reasons, but there's, one of the reasons was Mar Sayan, they were afraid that...
Right, so,
let's say other Jews that aren't religious might see a religious Jew on the train and say, oh, well, you know, they're breaking...
So that's an interesting point here. I mean, you are hitting on an interesting thing here. Well, I mean, two issues there. Mm-hmm. First, as we said, you know, you cannot say uniformly it's a prohibition. Like, I can say, you know, it's a bad idea, or I can say don't do it because of Mari dying, but I can't say it's usur. It's prohibited,
right?
Because unless I'm like doing it very locally for my community,
right.
It's not a unit. It's not something like when people have to say asur, right? Something's prohibited. I have to say it's either biblically or rabbinically prohibited. And then for things that are biblically rabbinically prohibited, they're prohibited for all Jews across all time and space. For my shul, like, or however wide my halachic scope is, I could say it's usher for this community, and I could say it's usher because of Maritain, and then it works, but on a very localized level. All right. Now, in terms of, you know, people can think, you know, there's one question about what is it that people are going to think. It could either be one of two things. Either one, that you are doing something prohibited, right, and therefore you're a bad person. Two, they could think, well, you're a righteous person, and you're doing something that we thought was wrong, so therefore it must be correct, and now we're going to start doing it.
Right.
That distinction is not really fleshed out in the Gemara, right? It just, the concern is that it appears like you're doing something wrong, but it doesn't explain what's the problem there. Meaning, you know, and I don't think it really mattered, because it was the Gzera that mattered more than the Mari Dayan. Right? Because if someone can look at it, you can just explain it, right? You can hang up a sign and saying, here's what you're doing, right? There are ways of getting around that problem. But it seemed to be irrelevant for Chazal, because they said, you know what, because this is how it might look, we're going to prohibit these specific activities. And they never really get to answering that question. Are you concerned with them copying you? Or are you concerned with them bad-mouthing you? Right? That doesn't get... that doesn't really get elaborated. The only exception would be if when you're in the public roles, like we saw in the first section about concern for public opinion, then we are concerned with them bad-mouthing you, right? But that's also in as a way of protecting not just your own personal reputation, but the reputation of the office that you hold, right? Because if you've got a gabbai tzedakah who does things under the table, right, then, you know, you're breaking down the whole system there, and you don't want people, you know, they're not going to say, oh, well, if the Gabbai Tzedakah can do this, then I can do this too. No, they're more likely to say the Gabbai Tzedakah is not doing things that are kosher, and therefore it's a complete corrupt system. So if you're in a high-profile place, then yes, it's where they may think you're doing something wrong. For the others, in theory, it could go either way, but it's not explicitly stated one way or the other in the Gemara. Great point, though. All right. So, thank you very much. Next week we'll get to Minhag, probably one of the most important classes I've ever given. And this Wednesday, our class on current Jewish questions is on interfaith interaction. Hope to see you then.
Boy. Okay.